J.W. Stevens, Imperial War Museum, accession number 11579-3, reel 2.
Brigadier Stevens, reel 2. When you were captured, was this your first sight of Japanese troops close up?
No, I'd seen them fighting. I mean, I'd fired at them fighting. I saw them every day. I'd seen quite a lot of them, one way and another. No, but not my first sight of Japanese troops, by any means.
What happened once you were captured?
We marched into Changi, and I was in a hut overlooking the bay, actually the Straits of Johor, and people sang songs and things like that. You know, we weren't taken over by the Japanese very quickly. Not for about 10 days or so. In fact, we had a cricket match while I was there against the Australians, which I kept wicket for the British, and the Australian, the ex-Australian wicketkeeper, kept wicket for the Australians. So I had a professional wicketkeeper against me and myself batting, wicketkeeping for the British. And I can't remember. I think the Australians won, but I can't remember now. But we had a cricket match, but that didn't last very long. And we were taken over and put into various parts of Changi.
What do you remember about the organisation of Changi Camp?
Good. It was organised by ourselves, by and large. And the organisation was very good, I should say. It was properly organised by our senior officers, as they were then. And this, that and other. And I should say the organisation was pretty good, one way or another. It was an unpleasant period altogether, actually. I helped build the Changi airstrip with troops and things like that, with my own troops. Or rather, with British troops. Not the Gurkhas were quite separate, of course. We never saw them at all. And they put up a very brilliant show indeed. The Gurkhas did.
In what way?
Well, we used to say, or what I used to say to myself, we shall be relieved in a month's time. And I said that for 3.5 years. And eventually it became right, because we were relieved in a month's time. And that was the end of it. But when we were relieved, I went across with Doc Evans in my battalion. And the Gurkhas were quite separately camped. And as we came upon them, we saw them forming up in a column of companies. And they'd cut branches of trees represent rifles, and somebody got hold of a Union Jack and put it up from on a post, and they came to attention and saluted the Union Jack. They had no British officers with them at all. And that was that. They were very loyal indeed.
Did you come across any of the so-called Indian National Army whilst
yes,
you were a POW?
Not whilst I was a POW, no, because they were fighting with the Japanese, you see, and I wouldn't have seen them as a POW.
But some of them were used as guards, were they not?
That I don't know. Sikhs were, yes. But the Sikhs were mostly Sikhs belonging to Singapore. They weren't, I don't think they were regimental Sikhs, I'm not certain about that. Yes, they were unpleasant. Yes, I did see something at the end, because I was sent off, I'd become a major while I was there, to a parade, I can't remember where it was, but somewhere not far off, where all the prisoners, or such prisoners as they get held, were paraded, and they had a lot of INA people with them, National Army people. And I called this parade to attention and gave the order, fall out the INA. And such INA as a president of this, they all fell out, and they were marched off by the 9th Gurkhas, who'd come in to look after us. So I saw them then. They all fell out, or most of them did.
What was the relationship like between the INA men and the Gurkhas?
The Gurkhas didn't know them at all. They wouldn't have anything to do with them. They're not very fond of Indians, you know. Gurkhas are Nepalese, and they don't belong to India. they're served with them, but they don't really like them very much, or used not to.
How long were you at Changi?
3.5 years.
Did conditions deteriorate once you were there?
Yes, a good deal. I was 7 stone when I came out. And I was 11 stone something or other beforehand. You had nothing but rice to eat, you see. You ate rice and rice and rice and rice and rice. And that's all you got to eat. We had some manure at one time or another, which was very full of vitamins for us. But it wasn't very nice to eat.
What was it?
Manure. It's not very nice to eat, as I can promise you. It was full of vitamins, we were told. And so we ate it. Fish manure it was. And that's all. We didn't get any meat or anything. We got nothing from the Red Cross at all. Nothing at all. Until just towards the end.
Was there any threat to take you to the railway or elsewhere?
Yes, indeed. Indeed. We were all told that a lot of us were going to be sent up to this railway. To this railway business, and we were told by the Japanese that we'd be much preferable to Changi, and we'd be well fed there and all the rest of it. And I then had about 14 years' service, and I thought, better the devil I know. It was done by a show of hands, so I didn't put my hand up. So I didn't go to the railway. It probably saved my life, actually, because I had a terrible time there.
What do you remember about the Selarang Square incident?
That was interesting, because we were marched there, the whole camp was marched there. And when you lay down at night, we were there for 3 or 4 days. You had your head on one chap and your legs on another, quite literally. And it was very unpleasant. If we'd stayed there any longer, dysentery would have caught us up, or something would have caught us up. And it would have been most unpleasant. And we were asked to sign this petition, you see. And we said, no, I'm sorry, we're none of us going to sign this petition. But the chap who was in charge of us, forgotten his name. Anyway, he talked to the Japanese. And he said, no, I can't. We can't sign this. But if you insist upon his signing it, then I'll sign it. Because you've insisted upon it, and I've got to sign it. So he'd signed it and didn't mean anything. We took no notes of it. And anyway, none of us tried to. Three doctors tried to escape. And I watched them being shot, which was extremely unpleasant. 8 shots to kill each officer. And they were captured and shot straight away. And one had to watch this, which was unpleasant.
Why did it take so many shots to kill them?
Because they started on their ankles and they finished up with the heart. They went upwards, you see. And they were shouting out, this is where my heart is, hit me here. And it took 8 shots to kill most of them. All three of them, actually, as far as I can remember.
So it was a deliberate form of torture?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Very much so.
Where was that carried out?
In Changi.
Whereabouts in Changi?
Oh, I don't know. It's a big area. Somewhere where we could all go to. One went there once off.
So everybody was assembled to witness the execution?
Most of them, those who were present. Anyone who could go saw this happen. And so that was that.
At what stage in your captivity would that have occurred? At the beginning, or the middle, or the end?
More like the beginning. I think after about a year. I can't remember exactly.
And these were 3 RAMC men?
Mm-hmm.
Were they officers?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Did you know them personally?
No. I can't remember that I did. It was a very big camp, you know. There were a lot of people in it.
Was that the regular army that was responsible for that, or the Kempeitai?
Oh, it was the regular army, I should imagine. But I can't answer that one properly.
Did you ever come across the activities of the Kempeitai?
I'm just trying to remember. I commanded a battalion in Malaya after the war, you know. And, in fact, I got a DSO there, actually, because we killed more bandits than most people did. And, well, the battalion didn't, they gave it to me. And the Kempeitai were the sort of Nazis of the Japanese. I can't say that I did or didn't. I don't think I did. But no, I don't. I can't answer that one.
Whilst you were at Changi, did you see anything of the Japanese handling of the Chinese civilian population in Singapore?
No, not really. I can give you an example of what I saw in Singapore from the Gurkha point of view. I was working on a fatigue party down there by myself, and I saw some British troops come past, prisoners, and the Japanese standing there throwing them cigarettes. And their officers saying, leave it alone, but they didn't. They all bent down and picked them up, and so on. And the next party that came past was a party of Gurkhas, and the same thing happened. Gurkha smoked just as much as the British troops did. They took no notice. They didn't pick up a single cigarette. Discipline.
Was the civilian population of Singapore able to do anything for the prisoners?
No. I don't think so. They were too far away, really.
You said that you expected to be relieved
in a month's time. Well, one's imagination said that I'll be relieved in a month's time, and it went on until you were relieved, you see. You didn't give up, is what it comes to.
Did you ever think the Japanese could win?
No, I don't think I did. No, I'm sure I didn't, in fact.
Did you ever receive any correct or authentic news of what was happening to the war?
We had three underground wirelesses. I never knew where they were. And the procedure was that you had these open-air lavatories, which you used to go and squat on, and you would be detailed to go to the lavatory at certain times, and somebody next door to you would give you the news that they'd got on these underground wirelesses. And so you got, by and large, you got most of the British news. You then went back to your own section, having memorized it, and you repeated this to your own section so that they got the news too. Yes, we were pretty well taped on that sort of thing. I took Bill Slim round when I was released, and I found that one of these things was actually in a chap lying on the floor next door to me who was taking down this news. I didn't know at all. We didn't know. One mustn't know these things, but one didn't know it. And there he was, and he'd been doing this for a long time. Very well done.
What was your opinion of the Japanese as captors?
Bloody awful, really, on the whole. But then they treated their own troops the same way, you see. I watched several Japanese parades, and a Japanese sergeant would come on parade and he'd slap everyone's faces. And then an officer would come on and slap the sergeant's face. And so on and so forth. They treated their troops much as they treated us, which was very unpleasant. They didn't torture them and things like that as they did us. And I was head up once. I got bad asthma when I was there. This business, you know. And you ought to know that's a doctor. And I couldn't walk very far. And I was sleeping in a hut with about six other people in a coolie hut about half the size of this room. And an aeroplane came over, and somebody shouted out, this is during the night, it's one of our aeroplanes. And so everyone got up and rushed outside to have a look at this aeroplane. And I got up, and I just got outside when, what did they call it, Japanese prisoners. Whatever word we used to say, there was a sentry coming along, and he came along, and all these others fled back, and I couldn't get back. And I thought I'd had it, you see, he caught me. And he stood me up against the wall, and he had a rifle with a fixed bayonet to it. And he went off, and he was going to stab me, and he came straight at me. I peed my bags, actually, you can't help it. And he stuck it in here, But he didn't kill me. I thought he was going to. You never knew what they were going to do.
He stuck it in your stomach.
Yeah, he stuck it in here, just a prick there. And but I thought I'd had it that time, but I didn't. And that just, and everyone, I came back, and they all laughed their heads off, which I didn't think was very kind of.
So he'd just done it to terrify you?
Yes, but I didn't know that, you see, because you never knew when they were going to kill you or not.
And did he just scratch the skin?
Yes, yes, that's all, yes.
Were you ever punished on another occasion by them?
No, not in that way, I don't think. You were worked hard, of course. You worked much the same as the soldiers did. And there was just lack of food was the main thing. One was going about 7 miles a day cutting down trees and then loading them up and pulling them back with a rope over your shoulder. You had to pull the trucks. There were no engines or anything. And that was hard work. And you were pretty well shagged out at the end of it. Because you had nothing but rice trees. Didn't get you very far. And that was.
Did you see much of the bombing raids on Singapore towards the end?
No. No, there weren't any really bombing raids on Singapore, actually. The bomb did the thing as far as Singapore was concerned. We were all going to another camp. They'd sent a lot of prisoners to various prisons to be locked up and filled them with petrol. Or rather, filled them with petrol and set them alight, which we didn't want to happen to us. And that might well have happened to us if we hadn't known. In actual fact, our job was going to be carrying ammunition for the Japanese gunners, which again wouldn't have been very pleasant, in the front line defending the oncoming forces. But it never came to that.
You said that you suffered from asthma as a POW. Did you have any other diseases?
I went blind in my right eye, which is, I can't see through it now, but it's nothing to do with that. The doctor who treated me stuck the needle in the wrong place 4 years ago, and I'm blind in this eye. I lost the sight in this eye, yes, but the vitamins put it back in.
Can you describe your liberation, please?
Yes, I can. The Air Force came across. Our Air Force came across, and they dropped down Defords, saying, "It's all over, and we'll be coming to fetch you," and this sort of thing. And of course, we were frightfully chat about all this. And I was sent off to take over an Isun camp, which was full of dying prisoners, Indian prisoners, 8 Gurkhas and thousands or so Indian prisoners. And I was given 11 officers to take with me. This was at dusk. And we got into a truck, which one of us drove, not me, and we drove down to Nisun. And as we approached it, it was getting dusk and I couldn't see properly. I heard a sentry come to attention, and I stopped the thing and got out to see who it was, and it was my own station wagon driver from the battle 3.5 years ago. And having greeted each other, which we did, I said, "I'm taking over this camp." His name was Pudbir Pun, P-U-D-B-I-R-P-U-N, Pudbir Pun. He said, "There's a house just up here, which there's some Japanese in it." The war was over then, you see, as far as we were concerned. And I said, "Well, I got no pistol or gun or anything like that. In fact, I have no clothes on at all." And I said, "Well, you jump on the step." And we drove up to this house, and it's a double-storied house. And I said, "Well, in we go." And he said, "It's all right, sir. I know these Japanese. I've been looked after by them. There's lots of Japanese for some time." So he went ahead of me, and he walked up the stairs and opened the door, and there was this Jap captain sitting down having his supper in full dress, sword and all. And when he saw me, he leapt to attention and bowed to me. And I said to this Jap in Gokali, "Amiru Kaganabatali, what will we do now?" He said, "I'll show you what we'll do, sir." And this Jap was standing to attention. He walked across to him, picked him up like this and chucked him out the window, and that's the last I saw of the Japanese. There was a frightful clatter outside, and the Japanese, I didn't see any more of them at all.
How high up was that?
It was a second story up. So I think he had quite a nice clatter. And he came back and said, I've been wanting to do that for 3.5 years. So I can remember him doing that. And I said, well, I don't blame you, and there it was. That was a little story. Anyway, that was correct too. And then I had another story. The troops landed. What was the name of it? Anyway, the invading troop landed. And we were down. The Japs had locked themselves up in cages. They're very efficient chaps, these Japanese, when they're working. And we saw these boats coming from these battleships and things with soldiers with fixed bayonets and all the rest of it. And we were shouting out, it's all right, it's all right, come along, there's nothing here. And, get out of the way, they said, get out of the way. And so we got out of the way. But when they landed, we said, it's all right, they're all locked up, we've got nothing to fight at all, they're all finished, done with. And they were very annoyed about this. They couldn't have nothing to go and bump off. And that was that. And then they all settled down. And I was commanding this Nee Soon camp, and I'd got this book here, to send off to Adeline. And
this was your wife?
Yes, downstairs now.
And your book of letters?
That's it. And so I went off to the Rapway place, and some major chap came rushing up to me. And he said, you're late, you're late. And I said, what am I late for? I've been late for 3.5 years. He said, I haven't got time to talk now, come with me, come with me. So I went with him, and he took me along to a jeep where Bill Slim was sitting. Well, I'd known Bill Slim before. And he looked up and he said, you're late. And I said, I'm sorry, sir, I've just told this chap, I'm a prisoner of war, I can't help being late. And he said, God almighty, who are you? And he said, you're John Stevens, aren't you? And I said, yes, I am. And he said, well, anyway, you're not who I sent for. Can you take me around these Japanese camps? And I said, yes, I can. So I got in with them. He had Master General of the Ordnance and Tamar, who was an Indian brigadier, and myself. And we got to Nisu, to the women's camp, which was all women, and there was a little child, a boy of about 5 or 6, playing outside, Starker. And Bill stopped his jeep and called this little boy across and picked him up and put him on his knee. He said, what's your name? And he said, my name's Bobby. He said, well, Bobby, I've come all the way down from Malaya to get rid of these nasty old Japanese. And I've got that nasty old general that's been so unpleasant to you, running around the jail with a fixed bayonet behind him. Bobby thought for a moment. He said, serve the old bugger right, he said. that was the end of the story. But I finished this up with Bill Slim about 4 or 5, 5 or 6 years later. And I said, you remember that? And he said, indeed I do. He said, I got a letter from the Foreign Office saying this is not according to the Geneva Convention. And I wrote back and said, I must keep the general fit for court-martial. And that was the end of the story 6 years later. But it was a good story, a true one.
How had you come to know Bill Slim?
Well, he's a Gurkha. He was 6 Gurkhas. Very much a Gurkha.
What kind of a man was he?
Oh, first class. I think the best general of the war myself. Absolutely first-class general in every way. The Eastern War was never taken much notice of here in England, you know. And people don't know where you fought or what you fought in or the rest of it.
I think that you've got some memories of the partition of India, in particular in relationship to the offer that was made to the Gurkhas to join either the Indian Army or the British Army. Can you tell me what you personally remember about that?
Yes, they were offered these things. We made up our minds about that. Our government, which was a Labour government, picked the four regiments which became part of the British Army. Let's say the 2nd, the 6th, the 7th and 10th Gurkhas. it was picked by the British government. The rest went to the Indian Army. He could have had the whole lot, of course, the greatest of ease. And what did you ask me now? What do I remember about
I think that most of them joined the Indian Army rather than the British Army, did they not?
They went to the Indian Army, yes. I mean, they didn't want to go to the Indian Army. They did as we told them to, roughly speaking. We could only take four regiments. So we were told. We'd have had a lot of it if we'd said so. So I understand. And I'm trying to think, is there anything... I was at the time commanding the 3rd Battalion of the 3rd Gurkha Rifles in Calcutta. I'd been to Staff College in the meantime. And I had to hand them over to the Indians, which I did. I had a letter. Mountbatten wrote to us, or put up a notice saying if anyone would like to serve on for a year while I'm Lieutenant General, or Lieutenant Governor, I should be very pleased to see it. And I said I would. And having said that, I commanded these chaps for about a month or 3 weeks and got a letter saying he will hand over immediately to the Indians. So I handed over to the Indians and got in a jeep and off I went. Off I went to catch my ship home, or catch my ship to New Zealand in this case, actually.
Did the Indians offer better conditions of service?
Oh, no. Nothing like it. Nothing like as good as ours. This is far better. Far better than they're getting.
You said that you were with the Gurkhas in the Malayan Emergency.
Yeah.
Can you tell me something about that, please?
Yes, I can. I was commanding the 1st Battalion and the 2nd King Edward the 7th Zone Gurkhas, and I was engaged in battle the whole time. And it was merely a matter of making out your plans as to how and kill these bandits and what to do about them and how many companies to send out and all that sort of stuff, which is part of one's duties. And one proceeded with this as best one could. And we did very well. In fact, we killed a good deal more bandits than most of them did.
Whereabouts in Malaya were you mostly operating?
Mostly in Johor, in that part of the world, to a great extent. I had 3.5. What do you say? I had best. Well, I commanded for about 3 years, but I was taken off at one time to command a brigade, 48th Brigade, I think it was, which I did, and that was pursuing bandits too, and doing exactly the same as I was doing as a CO, really. But you were commanding four battalions, whatever it was, 3 battalions, and sending them off to bump these people off if you could.
Did you go in the jungle yourself much?
Oh, yes. I lived in the jungle, practically. Not all the time. One had a moving headquarters, more or less moving. And you came back to your headquarters and went off when you had to. Went off in the jungle or whatever you had to do. Which, of course, I knew a little bit of, having fought in it on the way down during the war.
How difficult were the guerrillas to find in the jungle?
Very difficult, because you never know where they were, you see. You were always looking out for an ambush the whole time. You never knew when you were going to run into an ambush. Luckily, I didn't have, never did do. And because if you did, you were prepared for it, and the troops knew exactly what to do. But they always had the initiative. They could say where it was and what you wanted to do and that sort of thing.